Hi, this is Ethan Siegel, theoretical astrophysicist. I got my PhD from University of Florida in 2006 in physics. My thesis was titled Cosmological Perturbations and Their Effects on the Universe from Inflation to Acceleration. And my specialties are working on early universe physics, on dark matter and dark energy, on the origin and fate of the universe. And more recently, I've focused my efforts on writing and communicating about science to the general public through books, through speeches, lectures, and most famously, my blog Starts With a Bang.
One thing that I've heard is that the discovery of gravitational waves, eventually it could let us probe past the cosmic microwave background that we were talking about earlier.
You know, that's true. So this is a prediction from what we know as inflation. If you didn't have inflation, you would predict that when you got all the way up to arbitrarily hot and dense energies, you would get a particular spectrum of gravitons. And if you want to go back through the literature, you can find a paper from, I think, 2005, maybe 2004, titled A Thermal Graviton Background from Extra Dimensions. And you might even recognize the first author as me on that. but yeah, you can get a spectrum of gravitons or gravitational waves from the early universe. If inflation is correct, you should get a specific signature. If inflation's not correct, you should get a very different signature. So being able to detect one of those two signatures should be another test of inflation. The only difficulty we have is that with the inflationary prediction, it's model specific what the amplitude of that signal is. We know what the spectrum of those gravitational waves should be, but the amplitude is unknown, and there is a tremendous amount of wiggle room. So people are building detectors to try and look for that signature of gravitational waves from inflation, but only if we get a particularly kind variant of inflation are we going to be able to detect that background with our instruments. If inflation is a model that produces low amplitude gravitational waves, we won't be able to see it, but they should exist. And that's something that, you know, is on the frontiers of gravitational wave science right now.
Yeah, and gravitational waves can also be detected by themselves or with other messengers, tri-messenger or bi-messenger events. And so that is sometimes referred to as multi-messenger astronomy. And so now we can finally talk about the GEMMA Summit and MMA. So you wrote an awesome article a week and a half ago about MMA and why it's the future of astronomy. So could you give us a definition or a description of multi-messenger astronomy and some examples of it?
Yeah, so long before you had sumo wrestlers fighting, you know, Brazilian jiu-jitsu fighters, and before you had like Ken Shamrock and all those guys, MMA was a concept that was well known to astronomers. But it wasn't mixed martial arts, it was multi-messenger astronomy. And, you know, you can think about all the different ways we look at the universe, you know, the gamma rays, the X-rays, the ultraviolet, the visible light, the infrared, the microwave, and the radio. And you can take all those different ways and note that they're all looking at different forms of light. We call that multi-wavelength astronomy. And that actually got started back in the 1700s when William Herschel discovered infrared radiation, which was a huge discovery. Over the 20th century, we got really good at launching observatories into space, at examining the full suite of this wavelength range, and seeing all the different signals we could get. But we recognize fundamentally it's all still light. However, there are two other fundamental types of signatures that we could also detect. One of them is particles. Instead of photons, we can measure electrons or positrons or neutrinos or any number of particles that exist from that are created in these catastrophic reactions. So in 1987, we had a supernova go off, and we got at neutrino detectors across the world, we started to see a flux of neutrinos. Three different detectors saw signatures of neutrinos hitting their reactors. They all came from the same source in the sky, from the same direction, and they all arrived within about, I want to say, 10 to 13 seconds of one another. And they got a total of 21 neutrinos at these different observatories. And then a few hours later, light arrived from that same direction in the Large Magellanic Cloud, because a supernova had gone off just 168,000 light years away. The neutrinos were produced first, and because neutrinos do not interact with matter, they simply traveled through the star that generated them to our detectors. The light took a while to propagate out, and that's why it arrived a little bit later. So we look at that and you say, oh, that's a fundamentally different type of messenger. That's a particle. It's a neutrino. But in general, it's a particle. And it came along with the light. This allowed us to do all sorts of things we could never do without the particles. It allowed us to understand the nuclear reactions that took place during the conflagration stage. Of a type 2 supernova. It allowed us to measure the speed of neutrinos and place constraints on their mass based on their energy. It allowed us to compare the speed of neutrinos to the speed of light and find they were indistinguishable. We could start doing neutrino astronomy because of this event. So today we have other particle detectors that are much more sophisticated, things like IceCube that have detected cosmic particles from not just hundreds of thousands, but from billions of light years away. This is extremely exciting. But we also have, thanks to LIGO and Virgo and the new generation of gravitational wave detectors, we also have the ripples in space itself. We also have gravitational waves, which are fundamentally their own type of messenger. You have to have different specialized detectors to do this. A gravitational wave detector with its twin laser arms, it doesn't look like any type of telescope you're used to because it doesn't collect light from the universe. It just measures how distances change in particular orientations over time, which is the effect of a gravitational wave passing through you. So these three fundamentally different types of signals, or messengers as we call them, is where the idea of multi-messenger astronomy comes from. That yes, you can learn a lot from gravitational waves, or from cosmic particles, or from light. But you can learn unprecedented amounts about the universe when you observe these signals in concert, when you observe them together with one another. So when we saw the binary neutron star merger in 2017 and we got gravitational waves and electromagnetic signals from it, we learned about a number of things like the origin of gold in our universe and heavy elements and what a kilonova is and how it's tied to short period gamma ray bursts. We were able to do all of this because we got this multi-messenger signal. And as we look to the future of multi-messenger astronomy, we know a whole host of wonderful things are coming. We're going to, at some point, get the first trifecta signal, where we detect gravitational waves and particles and electromagnetic radiation from the same event. We're going to see, close up, a black hole merger or a black hole neutron star merger, and we will get to see, is there an electromagnetic counterpart signal to them at all? When the next supernova goes off, yes, we will detect neutrinos and light from it. Will we also detect gravitational waves from it? That's a very interesting thing to look at as well. So there are lots of fascinating things that are coming in the pipeline, where these are questions that we have ideas about but not answers to, and we're going to get the answers to them over the coming years and decades.
Well, hopefully listeners of the GEMMA podcast know that GEMMA stands for Gemini in the Era of Multi-Messenger Astronomy. And so multi-messenger astronomy is part of Gemini or GEMMA, but also TDA is as well. Is there anything TDA-wise that you're excited about in the future as well, like future surveys or detections?
You know, I'll say, so TDA in general, this is a much less well-known acronym, and it's one that I would hope that we just stop using to the general public at all, because it means too many different things at once. But when you say time domain astronomy, this is any signal that either varies or is collected over time. So when you do event horizon telescope stuff and you do phase locking of your various different telescopes, that's time domain astronomy. But also when you watch a burst or a variable star or a transient event, that's time domain astronomy. From a cosmological point of view, the most exciting time domain astronomy thing that I can imagine is this is for the far future, but it's something that I see coming maybe within a century, is those hot and cold spots we talked about in the cosmic microwave background, those overdense and underdense regions, that comes from a specific region of space that's, you know, that it took the light 13.8 billion years to get here. Over time, that fluctuation pattern will start to change in shape, in size, as the light stops arriving from what's currently the appropriate distance region, and we'll start to see the light from behind it. In other words, we're going to start to be able, once enough time goes by, to understand how these cosmic perturbations, these overdense and underdense regions from when the universe was just 380,000 years old, we're going to witness them slightly change over time. So we will get to see what a three-dimensional look at these cosmic perturbations looks like. That's the most exciting thing that I can imagine coming in the relatively near future from time domain astronomy, even though that's a technology that's probably, you know, going to be pushing the boundaries of our lifetimes.
I can't wait to view that. Probably be in VR by the time that they have that kind of technology.
I'll be okay experiencing that in VR.
So we met at the GEMA Summit, which took place November 7th and 8th, 2019. Were there any interesting topics or problems that were discussed? Because I know we also had polls and discussions over the name itself, multi-messenger astronomy.
I mean, there were a lot of interesting things. If you wanted me to give you my three biggest takeaways from that meeting, the first is that nobody likes the name multi-messenger astronomy, and nobody, really nobody, likes the term time domain astronomy. But this is what astronomers are using, and we don't have an immediately superior term that makes everyone happy. And so we looked, we saw it, and we failed to find them. That doesn't mean it doesn't exist, but it also means maybe like primeval fireball, even if we found the ultimate term, that people would still be like, nah, I don't want it. And that's fine. But it's the old Shakespeare to me, a rose by any other name would smell just as sweet. So if this is what we're going to call it, we might as well call it that. But let's do our best to communicate the thing that matters. The fact is, it doesn't matter that this is multi-messenger astronomy. What matters is that we are getting these fundamentally different types of signals from the universe, combining them together and learning more than we can from any method independently. That is the big takeaway. The other thing that I think is a huge takeaway is how we communicate this matters. When we're an institution that makes a big discovery or a collaboration, it is so important to have a unified message where you are getting that message across clearly and concisely to the general public. That is the most important thing that needs to happen, not satisfying the egos of all the hundreds or thousands of different members in the collaboration. We were able to identify some teams that really nailed this, and we were able to identify some teams that I won't put on blast on your podcast that could really use some improvements. And I do have some very strong opinions on that, that you know, that I know many of our colleagues and many of the other people at the GEMA meeting have as well. And I hope that this meeting was useful for them in pushing forward how we communicate science to the general public, because that is the reward that they get for investing in this, and I do not want to shortchange them at all. And lastly, the last big takeaway point I have from this is that we are pushing these frontiers of the unknown back, and we are discovering what exists in a place where we had only ignorance and conjecture before. This is the essence of science, is pushing those frontiers back, is learning what's behind that curtain, is revealing the next set of mysteries to solve that we wouldn't have even known what to ask before they were made. That this is not the end of science. This is not, oh, as astronomers, aren't you satisfied now? The answer is no. What we are learning now is, once we pull this frontier back, what is the next one? And how can we answer those questions? So questions like, yes, this is where the majority of gold comes from, but is neutron star mergers, are those the cause of all short period gamma ray bursts, or are there other causes? We still have to answer that. We are uncovering the tip of the iceberg right now, and that is amazing. But the next step is to measure the full extent of that iceberg, knowing full well that most of it is beneath the surface and invisible to us today.
Well, I'm looking forward to what MMA and TDA have to bring in the future. And thanks for helping reveal some of the mysteries of science for our podcast listeners today.
Well, it's been my pleasure. And hopefully your podcast listeners will come away from this more informed and more excited about multi-messenger astronomy, how it's useful for cosmology and the study of the universe, and where we're prepared to go with this new field of science in the 21st century.